Thank you so much for this very kind presentation. I hope I deserve it, so. And I hope you don't run away because I gave you this text directly in Latin. But I promise I will explain everything. I will do my best. So, what are we going to say today? First part of my lecture will be a very broad introduction to the topic in late antiquity. So, how in theoretical works authors deal with issues we are taking into account in our projects here at IKGF, so coping with the future, broadly said. Second part will devote to the figure of Draconcius. I will only need to add something to what was already said. And third, and I am very happy to do it, is a part on methodological issues. I hope this part will interest the most of you, and in particular the ones who, like me, deal with poetical works instead than with theoretical works. And then I will explain myself better thanks to a few concrete examples taken from the works of Draconcius. So, prophecy and broadly coping with the future in late antiquity is, as I must say, almost everything in late antiquity, a very complex topic and a very complex problem. I will only cursory mention this complexity in the theoretical authors, namely in particular in the church fathers. I have mentioned some names in the slide. You can read Augustine, Lactans, and so on. And for our texts, for the examples I am going to explain, we need to remember in particular this author complex approach towards prophecies, and in particular the necessity to distinguish between false and true prophecies, which was at the same time a classical theme, but also a new Christian problem, in particular regarding biblical prophecies, and for instance the book of Daniel and so the like. Another important topic we will focus on will be the relationship between God and the man, and in particular free will and human responsibility. How far is a man free to behave, and how can God actually influence his behaviors? So, as I said, I will not have the time to deal with these complex problems, and I just wanted to mention, in order to keep in mind that there's a broader frame we have to take into account. So, who was Draconcius? As we know from the very end, from the explicit of one of his works, he was vir clarissimus et togatus, which means he was, as we know already, a member of the elite and a lawyer, or a he had a juridical career. So togatus could mean exactly lawyer, or more broadly involved in the juridical career anyway. And he lived in northern Africa in the second half of the 5th century, namely in Carthago, and which is on the north over there. This is the maximum extent of the Vandal kingdom. And the Vandals were exactly the kings that from Germany migrated first to Spain and then to Northern Africa. So it's one of the first stories of migration, the opposite direction of our nowadays migrations, we could say, and they also are the first built, have built the first Romano-Barbarian kingdom. So these kings had a very complicated relationship with the elite of the northern Africa. They already found there, and Dragonzius was a member of this elite. His relationship towards these kings was not an exception. It was very complicated, as we know from one of the works we are going to analyze today as well, which is the Satisfactio. We will say something more about the work itself later on. What I just wanted to mention right now is that in these two verses, one of the most known from Dragonzius' whole production in general, we know something about a fault he seemed to have committed, and he said, "Culpa mi ifuerat dominos reticere modestos, ignotunque mi scribere vel dominum," which means, my fault was not to mention reticere, tacere, no? Not to mention indulgent lords, and to describe, even as a lord, vel dominum, one unknown to me, ignotum me. So the problem, scholars love these problems and they cannot solve. So the problem is, who is this ignotum, this ignotus, this unknown? So the classical hypothesis given by scholars were that this person was Zeno or Odoacer or Theodoric the Great. So people, important people, the emperor or kings of other barbarian kingdoms, not Vandals. So he celebrated as his own king, a king of another reign, reigns that had problems with the Vandals. So the most recent positions of scholars is that instead he's referring to someone inside the Vandal family itself, namely Hilderic or Huneric. In order to understand better this problem, I reproduced here the family of the Asdingi. So the person who is writing to in the Satisfactio is Guntamund. As you see, Guntamund becomes king in 484 after Huneric, who dies in 484. The idea of recent scholars is that Dragonzius is referring to Hilderic or Huneric himself. Why? As you can see, Huneric married Eudocia. Eudocia is the daughter of Valentinian III, which means that Huneric really was the first one who married a Roman girl. So his son is the first really Roman barbarian king to be. So the problem is in the law of succession of these kings. The law of succession was based on seniority, as it happens often with Germanic families. So the one who becomes king is the oldest in the family, but not the child, not the child, not directly the child. Huneric, after having married Eudocia, wanted to change this law and make his own son, who was Roman barbarian, directly king. So there were bloody situations, as is always happens when we have this problem, but then it didn't work. So the hypothesis that I would prefer, but I'm still working on, it's an ongoing research right now, is that in fact Dragonzius was favorable to this changing of the law of succession. Okay, so just to say that this episode had as a consequence that the poet was imprisoned. He was imprisoned for many years, the whole reign of Guntamund he was imprisoned, and that's where he initially wrote his Christian works. So the Satisfactio, directed to the god, to the king, but we will say it's not a lapsus without meaning, and the Laudibus Dei, the three books of the Laudibus Dei. The traditional scholarship about Dracontius thought that this twofold production, we will see in a second, is divided by the episode of the imprisonment. So before he was pagan, he wrote pagan works, then in prison he converted into Christianity and he started to write to God, which is not longer the case. We don't think that anymore. We don't know if he converted or if he has always been a Christian, but in any case, the chronology of the works doesn't work with this idea of the division made by the imprisonment. So anyway, we do have a twofold production. We have some works which are pagan, or we could say better, classical, and these works are the Romulea, transmitted by a single manuscript, the Codex Neapolitanus, and the Orestes Tragedia, we will talk about that later, with another tradition, manuscript tradition. And then we have two Christian works we already mentioned, so I will just say very shortly, the Satisfactio and the Laudes Dei, with a very different tradition, complicated also by a fact, which is that a few years later, Eugenius Toletanus, a bishop, rewrote the same works with meaningful modifications, and the Recensio Eugeniana is the text known during the whole medieval period, and is the text we used to think, before we found the manuscripts, was the Draconian text. So it's a very complicated situation for a philologist. So now, as I promised, before we go to the concrete examples, something about my methods. So as you saw, we deal with poems. And when we deal with poems, we are not dealing with theoretical works, which is obvious. We are not dealing with something like Cicero's De Divinazione, we have seen within the last two sessions of our interdisciplinary colloquium. It's something very different. It's something very different because in Latin tradition there's a very important point based on genres. So if I write an epic poem, I need to put into this epic poem some elements which are traditional. And if I and among these, the prophecy scenes are important. So, if I represent a prophetic scene into an epic poem, I will do that regarding also the tradition of the genre, from the one side. From the other side, in the case, specific case of Dracontius, we have a poet who was a lawyer and who wanted something from someone. He wanted to be freed by the king. So, these rhetorical strategies also have a very important role in his choice among the possibilities of the broader frame we were just mentioning at the beginning of our lecture. So, as we are going to see, he is choosing exactly what he needs in order to convince. So, we cannot say Dracontius' idea on prophecy is that. Thanks to Dracontius, we know that in late antiquity prophecy was seen as that. It's something different. So I think methodologically it is important to point out that a poem is not a theoretical work. Okay, said that, what is my approach? My approach is the approach of a philologist that takes into account the literary history. So when I see a part of a text, of a poem, which is based on prophecy, before I can say something about prophecy itself, I need to take into account everything that is important for a philologist. So the manuscript tradition and the literary history. So what kind of genre is this? What happens in the context, and why and how is this poet using the prophecy? And only then I can say, okay, in late antiquity he uses this and this and this. So that's too general for me. I don't like general things, so I will need to explain with some concrete examples. And I have chosen, you have the texts on your wonderful Latin papers here. I have chosen four examples. Three are taken from classical works, in particular from the Raptu Helene, from Medea, and from Orestes' Tragedia. And the last one is taken from the Satisfactio, so from a Christian work. Let's start with the Raptu. The Raptu Helene is defined by scholar as an epilion, so which means a small epos, a small epic poem. Small because of the quantity of verses, but also small because of the interest, because in epilia, the poet is also interested in the feelings of the characters. That's very, very general, so please keep it as obvious, which is not very obvious, but I have not the time to discuss here about genre and so on. The story is in 655 hexameters and is a narrative about the whole story of Paris, whose mother, Hecuba, had a prophetic dream about his responsibility as a destroyer, as the destroyer of Troy. She dreamed a fiery torch covered by snakes, which represented Paris himself, and namely, Paris will be responsible for the fire of Troy because he felt in love with Helen, but Helen was not a free woman. She was the wife of Menelaus. Menelaus, a Greek king, and then the Greeks, in order to take again, to bring again Helen to Greece, organized the war and the Trojan War. So in the end, the city was totally destroyed. We will focus on a scene, on a precise scene, which is a scene of prophecy, obviously, and this scene, the context of the scene is following. Paris, with Helen, comes back to Troy. So the people of Troy, in particular the royal family, Hecuba is the mother, and then the two she has two children, Helenos and Cassandra, who are seers, prophets. They have to decide if they could receive, accept Paris back in town. So the scene we are focusing on is on point one on your handout. And as we will see, there's a precise structure. The first two prophecies are the ones of Helenos and Cassandra, the twins, seers, that do not want to receive Paris, since they know this is gonna be the start of the end of Troy. And then they are apparently contradicted by the god himself, Apollo, at the end of the first column. So, let's start from the very first prophecies, which are structured in exactly the same way. We see the first one, Helenos. Helenos is described as a vates, and vates is a very important word in Latin, which refers both to prophecy and to poetry, and it's a very solemn word. The verb used to introduce his prophecy is exclamat, also a solemn expression. He says solemnly, we can say. The speech itself is firstly addressed to the parents, pater, mater, so father and mother. And he already at the beginning of the speech says that they have the responsibility in the future end of Troy. He says, quid perditis urbem? Why are you destroying the city? Receiving Paris here. What follows, is ec est illa, and so on, is the reference to the torch. Fax means torch. So, to the dream of Hecuba. Hecuba, as we said already, dreamed a torch when she was pregnant of Paris. So, Helenos is referring to this literary tradition, and we will see in a short second something more about this literary tradition. What follows, not immediately, after the prophecy itself, sed quid fata veto, and so on, is another very traditional, in Latin, I would say in Greco-Roman literary tradition, a reference to an important point, which is that a seer can see the future, but he cannot change it. So he says, why am I trying to avoid destinies? Why am I trying to avoid fixed events? When, he says, the foreknowing, the prudencia, is not helpful, not nil prosit, when the signs are unfavorable, adversis signis. So when the signs are unfavorable, to know them in advance doesn't help. So that's another reference to, that's a precise reference to the unusefulness of foreknowing. So that's a passage of tragedy of Ennius. So we are in another, at the beginning of the literary Roman tradition, with again the most famous Latin reference to the torch, to the dream of the torch. And here the speaker, as I would say always or almost always in Latin tradition, is Cassandra, so the sister of Helenos. So here Dracontius is doubling, so to say, the prophecies and giving to Helenos a prophecy or a reference, the reference to the torch that usually in the literature is given to Cassandra. Cassandra is, her description mirrors the one of Helenos. As we can see, she is introduced by a brief description, furibunda sacerdos, a frenzied priestess. Here the verb is cano, another very solemn word in Latin. And again, the first reference of the speech goes to the parents, mater, pater, and again to their responsibility in the destroying of Troy. Quid funera nostra paratis? Why you are preparing our deaths? The difference between the content of the two prophecies is that Helenos is referring to the destroying of the city in general, Cassandra to the problems they will give to the family itself, so the deaths inside the royal family. And again, at the end of the speech, which is a little bit longer and a little bit frenzy as well as the character herself, she also says, "Sed quid vana cano? Why am I singing unuseful things?" So again, as in the case of Elenos, a reference to the unusefulness of prophecies for the seer, who cannot change anyway anything. But she is optimist, as the women are sometimes, so she tries to do anyway something, and she tries to convince the people to kill Paris, her own brother. So now it's the turn of Apollo. Apollo appears in his old solemnity, and apparently he contradicts his own prophets, his own seers. As we will see, it will only be a superficial contradiction based on the ambiguity typical of oracles. So let's start. The solemnity of Apollo, here represented masterly by the Apollo Belvedere, a statue in the Vatican Museum in Rome, which is the Roman copy of a Greek original. And the text represents Apollo as solemnly as the statue. The key words of this solemnity are visus adest. Adest is the key verb in apparitions of gods. And Apollo is at the end of the hexameter. And in Latin literature, the position of words inside a verse is never obvious. When a noun, a word, or something occurs at the beginning or at the end or in the middle, before a caesura of the verse, it's emphatically positioned. So the name Apollo at the end of the verse has a solemn effect. And then also the reaction of the people is usual regarding divine apparitions. Tupuere Phryges, the Phrygian people, remain astonished. And then tacet ipse sacerdos, the priest himself is silent. So that's also a reference to the role, also biblical role of the prophets. Prophets comes from profari, and we see effatur. Effatur is the verb used for Apollo, which means to talk, to solemnly say something. A prophet is the one who profari, is the infinitive, so who speaks instead of the god. Clearly, if the god is there, the priest, the prophet, doesn't need to speak anymore. So he touches, he's silent. And as we see, the very beginning of the speech, of Apollo's speech, seems to contradict everything. Quid virgo canit? Why this girl is singing? And he uses the same verbs we saw the poet used to introduce the characters. Why the other one is prophetizing? They are scaring, Elenos in particular, is scaring the people, the town. Apollo's strength is also underlined by his references to destiny. He says, fata vetant, destiny does not allow. Stant iussa deorum, mandates of the gods are fixed. He uses very concrete verbs. So he knows he's the god, he knows. That's the characterization of the god. So at this point we should ask ourselves, what is he going to prophetize if he contradicts them? And what is going to prophetize is something the reader, Dragonsus reader, understands immediately, but the Trojans cannot understand. And it's based on ambiguity and on the reference to another time. So Cassandra and Helenos are referring to the immediate time of Troy. Apollo is not mentioning a very whole story we will see in a while, and but he is also prophesizing true prophecies, which are related not directly to Troy but to Rome. Let's see. I paraphrase in English this text you are on the slide. The Trojans will reign everywhere in the world. The poetical device here is the reference to the chariot of the sun and to the climatic zones. They will have power on the whole world, and their race, Origo, will reign for a not short time. Tempore nec parvo, a not short time. Here we can focus very briefly on this rhetorical device, which is named litotes, no? To say not short instead of saying long. With which effect? The expectations of the listeners of Apollo in the scene were oriented by former prophetic speeches towards a short duration of the Trojan city and power. So that's what Helenos and Cassandra said. We are going to be destroyed shortly. So to use the adjective parvus, short, corroborates the strong opposition, the apparent contradiction between Apollo and Helenos, Cassandra. At the same time, the god is playing with ambiguity as well. As we know from recent studies on the cognitive effects of litotes, in fact, it is not exactly the same if we say long or if we say not short. Because in this second case, we are still saying something and then refusing it. We are still saying short and then saying not short, which is very, very cognitively very different than saying directly long. Moreover, here the god starts to be ambiguous. He says Troum Origo, the race of the Trojans, the descendants of the Trojans, but not the Trojans. And as we all know, Troy will be effectively destroyed by the Greeks after the arrival of Paris. So an intertextual reference leads us to some conclusions. The expression imperium sine fine dabit, which means he's gonna give them an endless sine fine power, imperium or empire, but that's ambiguous as well in the original text we will see shortly, is with adaptation of the verb, here we have daddy, I gave, and not he's gonna give, coming from the Aeneis, the epic of Augustan period, written by Virgil, here in the first book, so a very important book, because the first books as the first words of the verse are very important, in the speech of Jupiter to Venus, referring to the power of to the power that Jupiter or the destiny gave to Romans forever. So, what is Apollo doing in the end? He pretends to contradict the seers, but everyone was right. Every prophecy was true. The only difference is the time they refer to. Helenos and Cassandra talk about an immediate time and about the end of Troy. Apollo refers to a further evolution of the story, but he doesn't mention a very sad part of the story, which is important to go further, and which is the fleeing of Aeneas, the escape of Aeneas from Troy, when Troy was in fire, which we know from the Aeneis, which was many, many times represented in art, and simply it doesn't mention this. So, as we know, oracles are ambiguous, they don't say everything, but they are true, at least in this case. The following examples will be a little bit shorter, don't worry. The following comes from the Medea. Medea is again an epilion on the whole story of Medea, which is also a very bloody story. I just summarized briefly. She has both an epic and a tragic tradition, and was very well known in late antiquity. And as we can see here from one of a series of sarcophagi. Here is the Basel Medea sarcophagus, and it's a detail where you can see on the right Medea with the body of one of the sons, because she kills, now I'm going to explain the whole story, with the body of one of the sons on the shoulder, the other son is on the chariot, you can see the leg, and she is escaping from the scene. The story is following. Medea is a princess, and she is also a magician. She falls in love with Jason. She helps him taking from Colchis the golden fleece, and then she goes with him to Greece. As many men, he forgets the help of the wife, and he marries another woman. She is not very happy with that, so she takes her revenge by killing their own sons. The version of Draconis is even more bloody, because Medea is represented as the priestess of Diana, and she kills five people in the end. The new wife and her father, Jason also, and the two children, as victims, sacrificed victims for the goddess. One of the other modifications of the story made by Draconteus is that he represents, as usual in Epilia, and in his whole production, a marriage between Medea and Jason. That's also new, because in the Latin tradition, the union between Medea and Jason was not represented as an official wedding. And that's also why Jason tries to convince Medea that he's doing the good things, because they are not married in the end. Okay. So, during the wedding, there in Latin tradition, there were omens, and the omens were made by gods. The Diana's prediction, the Diana's omen, is actually a curse against Medea. She says, "Non homine Fausto coniungantur," with an unforable, you are marrying each other with an horrible omen. And that's a very important dramaturgical point for the story, because in the end everything will be made to make Diana happy again. Next example comes from the Orestes Tragedia. The Orestes Tragedia is a late antique Oresteia in 974 hexameters. And it's the story of Orestes, you can see him on the left, killing his own mother, because she has killed her husband before. So the story was traditionally related to the themes of fault, which is very interesting for a lawyer in general, and a new element introduced by Draconteus is this dream. It's a dream. The dream of Pylades and Orestes, that they both, at the same time, sleeping at the same time, they both dream of Agamemnon, the father killed by Clytemnestra that Orestes wants to avenge. This is new because usually and traditionally it's the oracle of Delphi that pushes Orestes to avenge his father. Here it's everything inside the family. And killing of Clytemnestra, here she's showing her breast to the sun in order to convince him not to kill her. In Draconcius, the scene, we have the same scene, but the representation of this scene is focused on the idea that the son is purifying his mother from her sins while he's killing her. That's what he said. So, how this representation of the ghost Agamemnon works? Very traditionally. As we see, the ghost is not, we see this structure, non qualis, blah blah blah, sed qualis, blah blah blah, which means he does not appear as he was after a war he won, so triumph, but said as he was when he was killed. This, so with a very expressionistic description of his sadness, his trembling, his crying, his white and still bloody and so on. So this representation of a ghost as he was when he was dying, in the moment of his death, is traditional. As we know, again, from the Aeneis, here is the representation of Hector dying, of the apparition of Hector to Aeneas, and he's represented at the in the same way as he was when he died. Very sad, mestissimus, and then crying, largos fletus, means he was crying, and then we have this image, raptatus bigis. We will see that in a while. He was dragged on the by the chariot of Achilles. The image is this one. So this one is an image of a sculpture, but it's clear he was dragged by Achilles, so the body was not very well in the end. And the same image of Hector as an apparition here to his own wife is in Senecan tragedies, occurs in Senecan tragedies, where we can see the precise model of Draconcius, because you say non qualis, again said blah blah blah, so not nice and as I remembered him, but as he was when he died. So, first element, the dream is traditional because the ghost is represented as he was when he died. Second, new, almost new element, it's one exactly the same dream for two friends. Ambobus, for the two of them, Visus appeared, Atrides means Agamemnon, insomnis, so while they were sleeping. With different reactions. Orestes, the son, is astonished, as it's also easy to understand, and the friend, Pylades, is non cunctator. He doesn't want to wait. He wants the friend to react. So, this idea of a ghost appearing in a same identical dream to two friends is a reference to a proverbial friendship, which was the friendship between Orestes and Pylades. They occur as example of good best friends already in Cicero's De Amicitia, so on friendship, and again in late antiquity in Augustine, in a few passages of Augustine. So, and we are almost done, please don't run away. Our last example comes from the Satisfactio, as promised. So we are now in the Christian side of the Draconcius production. As we said, it is a poem written while the poet was in prison. And we have, it is a poem of 316 verses in elegiac couplets, and which is the sad matter of Roman tradition, so to say. And it is about the fault, the poet's fault, and his hope to be freed. As it happens often with Christian poems, there's a double addressee. Rex in mense Deus is the first verse. You also have, I think, yes, you also have it on the second page of your handout, which means infinite God, who you are a king. So as you can see, it's kind of ambiguous because it's referring clearly to God, but the first word is Rex. And we know from the explicit of the manuscript and also from other sources that Draconcius is writing to the king. As you can maybe read, explicit Satisfactio, this is the end of Satisfactio, the title, Draconci, the author, ad Guntamundum regem, Guandalorum, which means Vandalorum, dum esset in vinculis, while he was in prison. So the addressee is clear also from our manuscript tradition. And to mention the royalty, which is traditional, biblical, and so on, but to mention the royalty of God at the very beginning of a poem addressed to a king, saying Rex, has a meaning, it's not meaningless. So, if the God is addressed for references to his mercifulness, why is the king addressed? Obviously, for a persuasive aim, we need to take into account when we want to analyze then other theoretical issues inside the poem. For the persuasive aim, which is pervasive in the whole composition, I have chosen these three verses where you can see a quotation of an expression, Rex Dominusque, Pius, which is an expression we also know from coinage, as you can see. The first side of the coin represents the letters D and N, which is the abbreviation for Dominus. And on the other side of the coin, you see DN again, Rex, Gun, Tamundus. So, Dominus Rex, Gun, Tamundus. This definition as Dominus was not very common for kings at that time. It was common for emperors. So if a king of a Roman barbaric kingdom wants people to call him Rex Dominusque, it means that he has a very huge opinion of himself, and that he has also ambitions on the global situation of the period. So he adds, Draconcius uses it because he knows that Guntamus would appreciate this. But he adds an adjective, Pius. Pius, which means merciful. So he said, in the last verse I'm quoting, ut vox vera sonet Dominus. So when the people, that's the old translation, when the people is calling you strongly, we can say, Rex Dominusque Pius, so King and Lord Merciful, please don't make them liars and make their expression dominus as true as the one merciful. So if they call you like that, they have to be they don't have to be liars. So you have to be Rex Dominusque, as you want to be, as we know from the coins, but you also have to be merciful, which means you have to free me from prison. So this persuasive aim needs to be always in our thoughts when we analyze the strategic use of arguments made by this poet. One of these argumentation devices is the so-called remotio criminis, which means I, as a lawyer, know that I am responsible for the sin, for the fault, but I the real responsibility is not mine in the end, because the necessity was I couldn't decide in another way. That's what, due to necessities, it was impossible for me to behave differently. So I don't deny I did something wrong. I'm just saying it was not my fault in the end, because I couldn't do anything else. And in the rhetorical handbooks Dracontius used during his education, this is called remotio criminis. And he said, how this remotio criminis, known from classical Latin, is used in late antiquity, and why this is interesting for us. The necessity he's mentioning is that God himself pellit ad illicita, pushes the man to the sins, which is not very, which is a little bit heretical, and which in fact was modified by Eugenius, the bishop who rewrote this this poem. And he said later on in another passage that this fault was huge, but is he deserves to be forgiven, because God, who can everything, when he created the world, he did everyone with faults. No one is completely free from fault. And he created the whole world as a balance, as a mix between good and bad. This verse, et bona mixta malis, et mala mixta bonis, was also well written and well known during the medieval times, and also by Goldoni, and also by many Molière, and many authors then reused this verse. So the creation itself testifies that God wanted also the man, hoc homo, also the man, as element of creation made by good and bad things. So the necessity, I did my fault, I am guilty, but the necessity was that, because we do have free will, he says in some passages, but in the end we don't, because we are created, and in the creation there's this mixing of good and bad things, so I couldn't be completely free from my fault. So, to sum up, we can define late antiquity, again, as we know already from other issues, as a crucial turning point in the elaboration of the Western thought, we could say, and on the capacity of harmonizing, if I can say that, classical and Christian thoughts, also regarding our themes, so themes of prophecy, of coping with the future, of free will, and so on. We also can sum up that poetry has boundaries, and that we cannot argue from poetry too much, because there's some rules in the genres. And then, just to close, we can also describe, also regarding prophecies, both in classical and in Christian works, Dracontius as a classical, pagan, but classical is better, Christian. So, thank you very much for your attention.